This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The Biltmore Estate. If you grew up in North Carolina, it's very likely on your list of memorable trips. But a lot of people outside the state are unaware that George Vanderbilt purchased 125 acres in the North Carolina mountains and built the biggest estate in the United States. Denise Kiernan became fascinated with the Biltmore when she was 14 years old on a family trip. Decades later, she found herself living in Asheville and was awestruck by the home once again. It inspired her to write a book, The Last Castle, epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. Unlike many of the Biltmore stories, this one highlights the woman who saved the Biltmore house, George Vanderbilt's wife, Edith. And Denise Kiernan joins our show from Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Hello, Denise.
Hello, how are you?
I am fine, and I am interested in getting into this story, but I do think that there are people who either know the Biltmore by name, know it not at all, or are intimately familiar. So for all of us, tell us again what this estate is.
So Biltmore House is the largest home ever built in the United States. There was never a bigger home before. There has never been a bigger home since. We're talking more than 175,000 square feet. That does not include the conservatory. That does not include the stables. At the height of his land holdings in and around Asheville, North Carolina, George Vanderbilt had in the vicinity of 125,000 acres under his belt at the height of his holdings. That is, we're talking larger than Washington, D.C. The house was built in the late 19th century, height of the Gilded Age, really, here in the United States of America, and remains, as I said, the largest home in the United States. But to me, it's just this fascinating, fascinating way to examine the turn of the 20th century in America through the lens of not just Biltmore House, but also the Vanderbilts who lived there, George Vanderbilt, his wife, Edith, and their daughter, Cornelia.
And George, of course, the grandson of the great captain of industry and infamous Cornelius Vanderbilt, right?
Oh, yes. Cornelius, a.k.a. the Commodore Vanderbilt, founder of the family fortune, who started off with, you know, really next to nothing in New York, and then via hard work and some very shrewd business dealings, created a spectacular rail and shipping empire. He left the bulk of his fortune to his son, William Henry Vanderbilt, who in turn more than doubled the money and holdings. And then George was William Henry's youngest child. So needless to say, wanted for nothing, absolutely nothing.
George, the bookish one of the family, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I mean, as a writer, I'm so in love with George's admiration for and voracious reading of books. He kept a diary in which he kept track of all the books he had read. He had specific binders in Europe that he preferred if he wanted to have his books specially bound. He had his own book plate designed. He could read in, you know, several languages. So his love for collecting books and, you know, just his bibliophilic nature in general is truly something that, of course, speaks to me very much. He wasn't interested in the family business. His older brothers were involved in the Vanderbilt, in the trains and the shipping empire. Even some of his brothers-in-law were, but George just, you know, frankly, he lives the kind of life I would live if I didn't have to work for a living. He went to the theater. He went to concerts. He, you know, he helped found, you know, a library in New York that, you know, helped become the basis of the New York Public Library. He traveled extensively. And, you know, one fateful trip brought him down this way toward Asheville, North Carolina.
Well, let's talk about that and how it is that he came to build it in that large estate right there in Asheville.
Yeah, so it was not unusual for moneyed families up and down the East Coast to come to the western part of North Carolina for vacation. This area, the mountain air was believed at the time to be curative. So if you suffered from symptoms from things like tuberculosis or malaria, there were doctors who believed that breathing the mountain air could be curative for you. So quite the little cottage industry developed in and around here, as well as an architectural structure that became known as a breathing porch, where people would come and see doctors and sit on porches and just breathe. And, you know, an industry builds up in and around this. So in 1888, when he was a young man, just in his mid-20s, he came down this way with his mother. And while his mother was, you know, breathing on a porch, George would go out riding and took in some of the most, you know, the beautiful vistas here. It's this Western North Carolina in and around Asheville is a beautiful, beautiful part of the country. And he thought this would be a great spot for a little country home. And he got Richard Morris Hunt on board. Hunt, hands down, the most celebrated architect of the Gilded Age, first American to ever graduate from the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, and to sculpt the beautiful gardens around the house. He gets the father of landscape architecture, Frederick Law Olmsted. So, I mean, when you talk about putting a dream team together, you've got, you know, the Vanderbilt Bank, Richard Morris Hunt, who had done all these cottages in Newport, and the father of landscape architecture. I mean, you know, it's hard to go wrong.
We have spent the first 10 minutes of this interview talking about the Vanderbilts. You spend most of your time in this book, and certainly the first part, talking about Edith Dresser, his wife. Tell us more about her.
Absolutely. It would be an understatement to say that Edith was one of the inspirations for wanting to do this book. I start the book with Edith, and I do that for a couple reasons. I wanted to show Edith as an independent woman, as a young woman, as a single unmarried woman before she becomes Mrs. George Vanderbilt, before she becomes mistress of Biltmore House. I really wanted to establish who she was and who her family was. She is descended of, about as old New York blood as you can get. It was a direct descendant of Peter Stuyvesant, who was the last Dutch governor of New York. She also was descended of the Fish families, who were very, very well known in and around New York society. But she, of course, did not have the same kind of money the Vanderbilts had. But she and her sisters and her older brother, you know, suffered some familial losses early on in their lives. And I think that a lot of that really helped form Edith as an independent, resilient, tenacious individual. One of the things I show early on, too, is the life of her and her sisters living in Paris. And it's just a spectacular thing to witness. And in so many ways, especially when you think of a young woman from a good family at the turn of the century, I mean, they were pretty much expected to, you know how to throw a good party, speak a little French, and get married. And that was pretty much it. And, you know, she and her sisters were really, really quite independent for the day and age. And I think that served Edith quite well when she suddenly found herself, you know, not on Fifth Avenue, not in Newport, not in Bar Harbor, but instead in the wilds of Western North Carolina.
Well, tell us how she took to life in the mountains.
Actually, I think she took amazingly well. One of the scenes I enjoyed most was her coming to Biltmore House that first time in the fall of 1898 after they had gotten married. They'd gone on a long honeymoon after that. And the very, very warm welcome she got at the house from everybody who worked there. But what I really found compelling about Edith was how she immediately bonded with the community in and around the estate, an extremely rural community, as you can imagine, turn of the century in Western North Carolina. She was the kind of person who there was a real intimacy to her philanthropy, to her interactions with people. She was not the kind of woman who would she and George were both very philanthropic, both as individuals, and then that continued when they married. She was not the kind of person who sort of, you know, sat behind these big fancy gates and wrote checks and sent them off to whoever might need them. I mean, she was the kind of person who would, you know, hop on a horse with a basket of blankets and food and go visit an employee who was sick, go visit the spouse of an employee who was expecting. This is the kind of sort of really hands-on giving that I find inspirational in the 21st century. When you think about this kind of behavior coming from a woman at the turn of the century, a woman who was the mistress of the largest house in the United States of America, I find it really inspirational. And so people took to her quite well in this area.
I was going to say that they did notice the fact that she was this kind of a woman, which may have helped ease their entry into the neighborhood, as it was.
That's what I really do think that, you know, she and George both, you know, they built the beautiful, you know, All Souls Cathedral in Biltmore Village is a spectacular church. And that was open to everyone. They built the parish school in Biltmore Village. George helped get the Young Men's Institute of Asheville off the ground. That became a center for African-American culture here in Asheville. They started a school of domestic science for young women so that they could be trained on how to work in a fancy house or back then in a very fancy rail car, because those were, you know, all the rage. And they also helped fund what became known as Biltmore Estate Industries, which had crafts and fiber work and homespun materials. And so it was just, and that's just the tip of the, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. They were involved in so many levels. She volunteered during World War I. She paid for a nurse to go travel overseas. She was always, always there. And they really did become just a really key part of the community here.
And as we said, you spend a good portion of the book, you start the book with her life in New York. George dies at the age of 51. And so you take up her story after that, particularly as it refers to the Biltmore itself, because it fell on hard times later on, right?
I think one of the things that I find interesting about found interesting about Biltmore House in general, and the reason I thought it would make such an interesting way to examine this moment in history, is because so much of what was happening there you could see reflected in other parts of American history or European history. So much changed financially in the early 20th century. You know, these folks were members of, you know, what was commonly referred to as the 400, right? So we talk about the 1%. Today, the 400 was reportedly the number of guests who could comfortably fit in Carolyn Astor's ballroom in New York City. So if you made the ballroom cut, you were creme de la creme of society. And all these folks had these tremendous houses and this tremendous upkeep. Well, in the early 20th century, you have several financial crises that happen that sort of upend people's stocks and people's investments. Around 1913, the tax laws change. And that had a drastic effect on people with inherited wealth. So there were a lot of factors that were affecting American history as a whole that we watch play out via Biltmore House. For Edith in particular, here, not only she loses her husband, she suffers another tremendous familial loss that I won't go into because it's a spoiler, but it's also very, very difficult for her. And she's facing all of these financial challenges related to, you know, George's dwindling funds before he passed away, but also incredible costs and upkeep, changing tax laws. And she really did not want the house to be knocked down as so many of them began to be. I mean, some of the most gorgeous homes up and down Fifth Avenue in New York, including George's childhood home at 640, just got knocked to the ground, some of them very unceremoniously without even, you know, getting some of the more beautiful artifacts out of them. Well, Denise, same thing was happening in England.
I just want to remind everybody, Denise, that I am talking to Denise Kiernan, who is the author of The Last Castle, and I'm doing that today on The State of Things. You're right. All of that was happening, and as you said, a number of those homes have been lost forever. What did she do, and why was she so committed to saving the Biltmore House?
You know, I think she saw what a tremendous place it was and what a tremendous setting it was. One of the things George did when he first began to work on the house was he really needed to help get the forests back in shape here. You know, we think of it so beautiful now, but when George came down here, the forest had been lumbered to within an inch of its life because we never thought back then that we could run out of trees. So he hires some very impressive foresters, first Gifford Pinchot and then Carl Schenck. And then he and Schenck start the first ever school of forestry here. Well, they really get the forest back on its feet. And one of the things that George had wanted to do before he passed away was sell off part of that huge chunk of 125,000 acres and sell it to the federal government, to the Department of Agriculture, so that the forest would stay intact, so that it wouldn't get sold off piecemeal, so that it wouldn't be developed. And that is something, I mean, literally, actually, on May 1st, 104 years ago today, on May 1st, 1914, shortly after George's death, Edith wrote the Department of Agriculture offering them, and it was just shy, the exact number is in the book, but it's just shy of like 90,000 acres. And this became the basis for Pisgah National Forest today. And, you know, so you could say George helped save the forests, and then the forest helped save the Vanderbilt family, because certainly that helped keep Edith afloat for a while. She sold off Biltmore Estate Industries. She worked very closely with the local judge, Junius Adams, who was a longtime advisor for the family. So she was constantly working to try and figure out a way to keep the house in one piece and to keep the surrounding forest protected. And, you know, as someone who lives here now, you know, we think so much about the legacy of the Vanderbilts. We think about the house itself, you know, what they built. But in so many ways, I think the biggest part of their legacy is what wasn't built. When you look at these spectacular forests in this area and what it does for our region on so many levels, in a way, I think it's what they didn't build.
Great stories. Denise Kiernan, journalist and the author of The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. Going to be speaking at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. She's going to be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro. We've got all that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Denise, what a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.